going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive, up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
Thanks so much, Capital. It is the Going Deep podcast. I am Donovan Bennett, and still in Olympic mode, but we transfer our energy from the Paris 2024 Olympic Games to the Paralympic Games in Paris that are coming up. And Canada has quite the team in 18 different sports. We are sending a delegation of 336 athletes. 9 provinces in total are represented, and there's a pretty special athlete that represents not only the province that I'm from in Ontario, but the city that I'm originally from, and that would be Scarborough. And that would be Marissa Papakonstantino, who I'm sure you've seen. She's going to her third games. She's huge on social media as a brand spokesperson for many. And she has a really uplifting story. She was born without a right foot, but that didn't stop her from her athletic dreams. She played soccer and basketball, but fell in love with sprinting, got a prosthetic blade when she was 12, joined a local track club in the borough of Scars in Scarborough, became the Canadian record holder a year later, still running now, and is one of our medal favorites in Paris. I talked about the fact that she is a brand spokesperson. She's partnered with Essentia Water, which makes a lot of sense because when you are training at the level that she is, you need to stay hydrated, something I need to be much better at. So I will endeavor to get some tips from Marissa on how she gets ready for the games, how she keeps her mindset fresh when competing, and how she stays hydrated. Let's listen to and learn from Marissa on all things Paralympic Games. So Marissa, everyone's super excited for the Paralympics to start. I know certainly you are. It must be somewhat tough to watch the Olympics knowing that your big competition is coming. How are you kind of mentally, physically, as you taper towards your big stage?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been really exciting watching the Olympics. I think in a way it just gets you really pumped and hyped for the competition, and especially seeing athletics and seeing the Stade de France. The stadium looked incredible and the track definitely looked fast. So I think these are just all things that we can obviously look forward to. But I think just like mentally and physically making sure that I am taking the time to recover as much as possible when it comes to my training and this final prep going in, because when you know, we hit that taper, you're not training as much and you're kind of getting ready for the big competition. But the best thing for your performance is to make sure that you're just mentally in the best place and emotionally just in the best place to have a good race and competition.
The track did look good. The color was outstanding. It looked fast, but also it looked extremely hot. And when you look at the competition schedule, it looks like it'll be hot when you're competing as well. When you talk about the preparation, where does hydration come into it at this point?
Absolutely. I mean, we prepare and train for these moments where you're in hot temperatures and hot weather and needing to refuel and rehydrate. Recently, just signing on as an Essentia partner has been really crucial to my recovery. You know, as an elite athlete, the training is obviously very important, but if you are not well recovered, if you are not well slept and well hydrated, all of those things really don't mean anything. So to be able to be partnered with a brand that has, you know, similar values and to be able to, again, just be able to refuel, rehydrate going into the competition is huge. And I think that I'll be able to have everything I need going into Paris to be the most prepared I've ever been.
Whoever you're talking to, whether it's a trainer or a doctor, they always say drink more water. No one it can drink enough water, but what's it look like for you considering how much you're training? What is the optimal intake for you?
Absolutely. So I think the ideal amount a day is about 3 liters, but that's on top of having electrolytes and different fuel throughout the day. But what's really cool about the essential water is that it's an ionized alkaline water with a pH of 9.5. So it's actually extremely good for rehydrating and making sure that also some of that electrolytes are going back into your system after a hard workout. So just having these at my availability when I'm training is just to ensure that I'm recovering properly and I'm able to take all of that into the next session and the next session going to Paris.
There's so much that goes into being a high performance athlete. Obviously there's the ability and the training, but you got to be a little bit of a chemist talking about electrolytes. You know, certainly you're thinking of your mental health and wealth. When you think of all of the hours of work that go into a quad, and the moment is such a small amount of time for you to advance to the next round or not. How do you manage, that discrepancy in making sure you show up at your best?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as an elite athlete, it's practicing good habits every single day from the start of the season to the very end of the season. And it's not just showing up to training and doing the training or showing up to a competition and running a race. It's all the small details and all the other things that really, really matter and are really important. Like I was talking about before, being well hydrated, being well recovered, taking account for your nutrition, your therapy, making sure that all of these things are in balance. And then at the same time, also making sure that your mental state is well recovered and in the best place possible. So having those mental performance sessions, and it's just all these details that add up to what you see at the Olympics or Paralympics. You just see, you know, I guess 1% of what athletes kind of have to prepare and go through on a daily basis. But I think for me, every time I have been the most prepared in all of those aspects is when I step on the line and I feel the most confident to prepare and to race.
Not your first games, and you know the excitement of being out of games, but you also, you know, the heartbreak of having your body fail you and not allow you to finish the way you want to, and have a hamstring pull at an inopportune time. How are you feeling physically going into these games, and how do you mentally block out the disappointment and push yourself towards hopefully a positive outcome?
I feel amazing right now. I am in the best physical shape I think I've ever been in, and the most trained I've ever been. Looking back at different experiences I've had in the past and different injuries and just letdowns and disappointments, they all were necessary and they all had to happen to get me to the place I am today. And I owe a lot to my past self because I had to endure all of those things, and it made me a much more resilient person for it. And it showed me that I'm a lot stronger than I thought I was to be able to overcome certain injuries and obstacles that I've experienced along the way. And going into the games, you know, I think that the best mindset and what's really treated me well is just focusing on my own race and focusing on running PBs. I'm in shape to run faster than I ever have before. And I think at the end of the day, my approach to when I show up to the games is going to be executing a race and running as fast as I possibly can. And wherever that lands me at the end of the day, whether that's on the podium or not, I can walk away knowing that I left every last bit of myself out there. And so that's where I have to balance that type of aspect, because in the past, when I've thought too much about that prize, that end goal, being on the podium, a gold medal, whatever that mindset was, it never treated me well and it never led to good performances. And when I took that pressure off of the podium and just focusing on executing and running my race is when I really untapped really confident racing.
I suppose you've had to have in some form or fashion that resilience and that growth mindset literally your entire life, being born without a right foot. How has the ability to take what life gives you and make the best of it, how has that changed your outlook, your mindset, the way you view challenges as opportunities in a way that many other people might not as naturally?
Yeah, I mean, I had to learn that from a really young age. I was, like you said, born without my right foot. And so I don't really know any different of having to adapt and reinvent myself and change the way I approach things and overcoming obstacles. And I think that's just something that I've had to naturally learn over time and through different life experiences that I've had. But I think it just goes to show that doesn't matter the cards you're dealt or what type of things you have to deal with or what obstacles come your way, there is always a way to find yourself to get over those obstacles and to push through to be that best version of yourself.
You know, I've seen a trend online recently of Paralympic athletes posting that they're competing at the games, not participating in them. A distinction that, if I'm being honest, from my privileged standpoint, I wouldn't have thought about until seeing it and seeing it in numbers. I would love to hear from you why that distinction in the language matters in the differentiator between the two.
Yeah, absolutely. I think language is so powerful in the way we use it and the context that it brings. For context, when I posted that trend that the Paralympics had asked myself and a bunch of athletes to take part in, I terrified a bunch of people, including my parents. They were like, why are you posting this? And it was definitely, there was a shock value to it of saying like, I'm not participating at the games. And then taking the time to actually like read, it's like, no, I'm actually competing. The difference between participation and competition are two completely different things. When you hear the word participation, you think of when I was in elementary school and I ran cross country and I came 70th out of 75 kids and I got a participatory medal or ribbon at the end. That's what I think of as participatory. But when you hear competition, you think of elite athletes pushing towards really high level competition. And I always, an example that comes to mind every single time is the German long jumper, Markus Rehm. If you watch him long jump and you see what he continually jumps, he would have won a gold medal at the Olympic Games. And it's just so incredible to see all these amazing performances. And that by no means is participatory. And so I think that this language that people are starting to think more critically about is a really positive way to integrate para athletes and the Paralympics as more of that high level competition versus something that, you know, you can just walk on a team for and make the games.
When you look at the Canadian team specifically, you look at the number of athletes competing, the number of sports they're competing in, there's a great diversity in this year's delegation. What do you attest that to? Because it's a trend that we're seeing in certainly athletics, but across the games altogether.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to see how much more diverse the team has become, even whether it's Canadian Paralympics as a whole or just Athletics Canada. You know, I think that just comes to the fact that I've been in this sport for like a really long time. I've been to, now this is my third games, and in the past 8 years, seeing the transition of where the Paralympic movement was before and the access it's had now to so many more people, I think it just goes to show that the development has increased substantially, and word of mouth and people realizing, hey, that person kind of looks like me. Maybe I can do that too. And so I think that that's just something that we are seeing a lot more of, and that diversity piece is so important because at the same time you want everybody to be able to come in, and if they feel like they have what it takes to make the Paralympic Games, to be able to, you know, get on that stage and perform.
Is there a momentum from the fact that at the Olympics Canada set a non-boycott record in terms of amount of medals that you see potentially carrying over to how we perform and show up at the Paralympics?
Yeah, I mean, this team that we are sending is one of the strongest teams I think that we've ever seen, not just in athletics, but I'm seeing it across the board on every sport. The level of athletes that have come onto this stage is incredible. And I think that the momentum of Team Canada kind of breaking that record is going to really carry through to the Paralympics. And I think not just myself, but all the other athletes are very excited to just see what we can do.
Having said that, I know so many people remarked about the fact that it was really cool to wake up in the morning and watch sports and cheer on Team Canada. I hope the break doesn't break that momentum. What would you say to all the people who were wrapped up in the great storylines and performances of our country to continue to have the same energy to represent for our Paralympic athletes?
Well, I mean, everyone talks about how sad they are when the Olympic Games finish. So just take a sip of water, stretch your legs, because it's coming back and it's coming back better than ever.
Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait, certainly. And lastly, I'll ask you about someone who's actually going to be covering the Paralympic Games for the last time, Scott Russell.
Yeah.
From CBC, who, you know, has interviewed you in the past. It makes a point not to just cover the Olympics, but makes a point to host the Paralympic Games. Having coverage like that from someone of that stature, what does it mean to the Games and to the movement?
It means everything, you know, like I was talking about before with representation being so important. You can't have, you know, more development, more athletes competing if you are not putting it out there and sharing it with the world. And for someone like Scott Russell, I mean, he's an incredible person. I've had the privilege of doing a ton of stuff with him in the past. And also, he's not only just hosting the Paralympics, but he's also a board member on the Canadian Paralympic Foundation. And so I think just having these influential people backing the Paralympics is massive, and just putting it out into the world. And you have, you know, athletes like Sloane Biles or Ilona Marr, huge platforms that are telling people, hey, sit down and watch the Paralympics in 2 weeks. And I think that that's really special. And I'm really looking forward to hearing from friends and family, you know, the Canadian broadcast when we get home, because in the past, you know, when it was back in like Rio in 2016 and even beyond, you couldn't really have easy access to watching your favorite Paralympic athletes. And so now that is definitely a reality. And I think a lot of people are going to be tuning in.
Well, you have a huge platform as well. So love that you're telling them that message, and love that you're making sure they're hydrated and part of Ascension Nation. So good luck, safe travels, and looking forward to seeing you once again at the Olympic Games in the mix zone, giving an interview. Hopefully the emotions are super positive and happy. But either way, enjoy the experience.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again, and good luck to Marissa. You can give her a follow on IG at Marissa_Paps is her handle. And while you're there, give Essentia Water a follow at Essentia Water. ESSENTIAWATER. She talks so much about the mental state that she has to be in, the mindset that she needs to compete at a high level, and really to compete in everything in life, given her circumstances that she was dealt with. I'm so fascinated by elite athletes and their mental performance. And that's become a huge industry. Being a performance coach is a essential role from my standpoint for every competing nation at the Olympics, and really should be for every sports organization, which is why I wanted to talk to Dr. Cassidy Preston. He's a mental performance coach for professional athletes and high performers in all different walks of life, whether it's surgeons or hedge fund managers or CEOs. He channels some of the challenges he faced as an elite hockey player into his work and into his writing. And actually, he founded CEP Mindset, which is a team of coaches essentially that approaches these types of conversations every day. It's quickly become one of the largest mental performance coaching firms in the world, coaching tens of thousands of athletes and high performers to do what I'm trying to do, improve their mindset and achieve consistent elite performance. So I wanted to talk to Dr. Preston, about for an athlete in these games, how do you show up with all of the pressure, all of the hype, all of the circumstance to be your best when your best is called? And what does that look like in the days, weeks, months, years leading up to the games? Having an Olympic mindset and mental preparation, up next on Going Deep. Let's listen to and learn from Dr. Cassidy Preston.
So Dr. Preston, we've all just come off of being on our couches watching the feats of these Olympians, or in my case, covering them. And the aspect of their performance I try to steal and maybe apply to my life is the mental mindset, because I know the physical aspect is not happening. In terms of tapping into the place they need to go mentally to be able to perform at a high level consistently, what does that look like? What are the key performance indicators for them to be mentally strong?
Yeah, I like three things. When I go working with somebody one-on-one and helping them perform at their best consistently, the first for me is breaking free from like the noise. Because if you go in with a mind full of noise, worrying about the past or the future, or you're chasing the results, or you're worried about the gold medal or what everyone thinks, you're not in a good spot. Like, it's going to be hard to be in the moment and trust yourself. So to me, that's the hardest part. And that's about acceptance and detaching. And you can care about something and have a goal around it, but let it go. And so, and think of that even just in our personal lives or working lives, like, hey, we have a goal and intention, but like, who am I being and how am I showing up? When we prioritize that and we let go of all the external stuff and start with the inner world and like, who do I want to be and show up? Well, that's where then we can get traction and we're going to be more consistent. So step one is breaking free and letting go and going within. And then step two is like, well, let's commit. Who do you want to be? Have clarity in how you want to show up. What separates really, really good athletes is they're very clear on how they want to show up. So then they can do it consistently, right? When you're running a podcast, like, who do you want to be? And how do you, if you're clear on that, you're going to be consistent. And so in any area of life, that clarity matters. And that's where you can really play with like alter egos, like the Black Mamba. My mentor, Todd Herman, helped Kobe create. We do that with athletes. It's like creating their identity, their character, the traits that they want to pull out and then do it consistently. So that's that 1-2 punch of acceptance, commitment, break free, and then clear and commit. The third thing we're always doing is enjoyment, because the bottom line, you got to enjoy what you do, the love of the game, the love of the sport, and staying connected to that and not losing sight of why you do it in the first place. A lot of times they lose sight of that. They think the why is the results as they climb the ranks. It's the money, it's the medals. Scottie Scheffler was a great example of that. I don't know if you saw online before the Olympics, they asked all the golfers some questions. And one of the questions was, what's your goal for the Olympics? And everyone goes to medal, to get a gold, to medal. Scotty goes to have fun. That was his goal. And then he wins. And then he wins gold. So it's like, you think people would clue in that like staying connected to the enjoyment and the fun and making that a priority is so important. So yeah, those are the three kind of main pieces. We can unpack that a lot deeper, but that's kind of what I preach and constantly, you know, working on, because athletes and high performers in any area, the context is always changing. You know, did you just win? Did you lose? Is the adversity? What did the opponents do? And so you got to keep breaking free. You're constantly clarifying deeper, continually to commit, and you got to keep staying connected to why you play in the first place. So that's the quick answer, kind of.
That's fascinating. You know, I heard Steph Curry say it during these Olympics. I've heard him say it a bunch, but it came up again when he was asked about the shooting slump he was in to start the Olympic Games. And he said, look, I don't waver. I never lose confidence. I put the work in. The results will come. We saw the results in the semis and in the gold medal game, and he went off when it mattered most. But that's easier said than done. How do you remain confident when the most recent data points that you have might be negative, which could impact your confidence?
Yeah. So he's a great example of what we're trying to get athletes and people to understand, which is like changing the definition of success or changing the definition of confidence. Meaning most of us define confidence based on the recent data points or the results. So when I score or get results, I feel confident. And when I don't, I lose confidence. What a terrible definition. It's like nobody's going to be consistently confident. And true confidence isn't about whether you've got results recently or not. It's about your ability to own what you're capable, the work you've put in. He's earned the right to be like, I know who I am and what I'm capable because of how much he trains physically, technically, mentally, and the work that he's put in. And so, yes, there's going to be variance in his results, just like anybody. There's always variance and, you know, other factors at play as well. But he can bounce back and get back to his capabilities, because I get athletes to not use the word confidence, but actually just focus on what are you capable and like, are you owning it all? Now, some athletes struggle with that also because they're just really hard on themselves, right? And especially a lot of pro athletes and high level people that are like, being hard on yourself can be very helpful because that's how you get better. Like, it pushes you to grow, but it can have a dark side where then your confidence struggles and gets down and you go deep into the dark hole, so to speak. So it's like, no, I want you to be hard, but also own your capabilities. Like, you can keep learning, growing, and have a high standard for yourself and learn and grow, but stay connected to the fun, stay connected to like, what are you actually capable despite all the other noise? And again, that's like an outside in approach to life or to sport or to confidence, where it's like, what's going on externally? Well, that dictates how I feel. Like, let's do it a different way. Let's go inside out, look within, who do I want to be? What am I capable? Why am I here in the first place? And then go tackle the outside world. So that's a great question though, but we all struggle with it because our society is very much living in an outside in world often.
So I'm guilty of this watching athletes, specifically Olympic athletes, where, you know, balance of their money is going to be made Olympic years leading up to the games. And then certainly if you perform well after the games, with speaking engagements, endorsements and the like. So that's real pressure. And when I see someone miss a gold and get silver or not get bronze and finish filthy fourth, I'm thinking, man, the compound interest, the money, the opportunities that they've missed. So if I'm thinking it on the couch, they have to be thinking it. How do you work with an athlete about getting them to not overthink all of the things that the results might mean so that they're actually thinking about the task?
Yeah, great question. And I think, and back to one of those first things, to detach. So one quick way of looking at it, sometimes when you don't have any control too, it's really hard to detach and put your head in it. But like, if you're there and you've got this shot, you know, you make this shot, you make this jump, you get a medal, you get more money. And if you miss, you don't. Like, you know what I mean? Like, very much like pressure type situation. And if you can't accept the range of results, right? And then, so as an athlete, I do this all the time. If you can't accept the range of results, so the range is you're either going to win or you're going to lose. You're going to make it, you're not going to make it. And we can't predict the probabilities, but there's always a range to a degree. Obviously, the more you're prepared and the more you're capable, higher probability. But when an athlete's having a hard time accepting and they're like, no, I need to, I should make it, and they're holding on to it, that's going to create that tension and not going to perform at their best when it matters most. So by accepting the range of results, what happens? They can let it go, stay free and light, and just commit to who they want to be, and then they'll deal with the outcome. But that's this hard part. And this is the funny thing I say to athletes all the time. Like, if you can't accept the range, don't be an athlete. Don't play pro sports. You can't accept, like, I had Connor Brown's gone, you know, Connor Brown with the Oilers, he's gone public with our work together. And he talked about this past year, because we started work together, he's in that scoring slump. And he goes to me, he's like, I'm like, if you can't accept, you might not score for the next few games, maybe you should quit. I'm like, I don't want him to quit. I never want athletes to quit. But it's like, the reality is you choose to play. You choose to be an athlete. You choose the profession you're in. And by accepting the range, it doesn't mean we have lower standards, but we just see it for what it is and detach, let go. And so by doing that, it frees them up. So now they can commit to who they want to be. There's a couple other, lots of other things in there that you could talk about with, like, focusing on the opportunity, be grateful, own your capabilities. Like, again, we want to commit and like, hey, I know I'm capable of doing this because I've done it so many times, like the Steph Curry example. But one of the big things to let go of all that pressure and that noise and the weight of the results is to accept and detach while still caring, but letting go of it, making it the main thing. Instead, make the main thing, who do I want to be? How do I want to feel here? And I want to play like this. I want to be in this kind of mental state. And that's what I call the mindset first, what my book and stuff's about, is like shifting that priority from what do I want to achieve to who do I want to be and how do I want to show up, especially when the pressure's on. so to speak. So yeah, that's my quick answer.
So both in watching the Olympic skateboarding, and I was at a skateboarding competition recently, as much as the feats impressed me, as I was watching, what impressed me was knowing that all of these tricks that they were pulling off, I know that they failed at them 8 out of 10 times in mastering them, which is probably self-selecting in that most people aren't willing to fail and land on their head 8 out of 10 times to master this trick. What are ways that people can become comfortable with failure or change the relationship with it to make it a positive?
Yeah, well, exactly that. It's talking about it. We get caught up in perfection in our society. You know, Carol Dweck's got all this great research on fixed mindset versus growth mindset, where it's like, it's good or bad. You know, I'm good and bad. I'm either good at it or I'm not, versus no, you got to fail, and failing is how we learn and grow. And we got to push ourselves in those challenges. It's funny. I don't show it as much anymore, but I used to show a lot of my clients, or when I present a video of a skateboarder trying to do a hard trick, and he would just fail over and over and over again. But you can see the moments of learning. You can see the moments of like, he's getting better and embracing it and resetting and accepting, letting go and committing to who he wants to be. And it was a good reminder to develop that growth mindset. And think of like the youth athletes, because a lot of the challenges is the athletes coming up the ranks too struggle with failure, or just people in general. And one of the hard parts with that is the discussion with parents. Do parents talk about all the failures that they have, or do the kids not see their parents fail? And so I'm a big proponent of like, hey, let's talk about our failures and share that with other people to normalize. Like, yeah, you're supposed to fail. Like, I had to do this with my 6-year-old daughter. She's like, oh, like, you think I don't fail? Like, you want to hear all the times I fail? I got a lot. And I was like, all the struggle I've went. And she's like, oh, that's interesting. And she's like, trying to open people's mind to like, this is just part of the journey. And changing the narrative around it really matters, right? Like, I do this with some of like a sales client and executives that do a lot of sales. Like, well, if you have a 10%, you know, closing on like cold calls, as an example, some like sales jobs, like, well, that means you need to get 90 no's out of 100 to get like 10 yeses. So it's like, you need to want almost to fail to know, like, otherwise you're not going to get there. So it's just change it versus like, oh, I got to avoid the failure. No. You got to seek it out in a way. Otherwise, you're not going to get to where you want to go. So you can do different analogies like that, that help and go a long way. But the story sharing goes probably the best way to look at it.
Well, I love that you brought it there, because I was going to ask you about children and kids. And maybe it's because there's a 5-year-old perfectionist in my house right now. But, you know, the title of your book is Mindset First. I wonder, when can you first start to try to influence the mindset of a child, so that whether it's athletics or any endeavor, they're in an optimal position for success and to deal with failure?
Yeah, I think the sooner the better. I think, especially as a parent, like, what's one of our main roles? To try to develop values and life skills and give them the tools to navigate through adversities and challenges and pressures and take ownership of their own mindset. Does that mean you're going to be like teaching it deep stuff to a 5-year-old or 8-year-old? Not probably too deep, but it depends on their mental maturity. But those little, you know, suggestions and reminders at a young age go a long way. You're not probably doing story time with Mindset First to a 7-year-old or 6-year-old at night, but to the average one anyways. But like, we've had people that are like 9, 10, 12, read the book. Sometimes they'll get one-on-one even coaching. And a lot of that coaching for the younger athletes actually with the parent and teaching them the language and the tools to support a child. And again, even with the 5 and 6-year-olds, it's like, again, teaching them about failure, teaching them about like, how do we learn and grow, and that the neural pathways in our head. It's like, I used the analogy once with my daughter about like, hey, you want to go from A to B in your mind and create, you know, unlearn new things, but you got to build that bridge between point A to point B to learn it. And it's like, you got to keep, you know, working on that bridge, and it takes failure and challenge. And then eventually you build the bridge, and then you want to strengthen the bridge and keep working on it. So that's what practice is, and teaching them different ways to think and operate. And especially with like the mindset first approach of like, hey, what matters most? Like, I was doing this with my daughter with soccer, and I was like, she didn't understand the rules. It's like, I don't want to be, hey, what matters most is winning. I was like, no, what matters most is like being at your best, enjoying the game, who you're being, which makes it fun. external goal is to win. You are trying to get the ball into the net, but like the main thing is who you're being, how you show up and enjoy and the lessons and the experience in and of itself. And then, I think those kind of that discussion matters because we can easily go into, hey, what do we want to achieve? Again, you talk about your perfectionistic someone in your household, right? So it's like, hey, no, not do we want to achieve perfection? Let's debunk that and make that not the main thing. Of course, we want to do really well and get better and continually improve and have high standards. And we want to learn along the way. Let's make the priority enjoying the experience, right? How do we feel out there? Are we learning? Are we growing? Like those are intrinsic drivers. We have extrinsic motivation, achievement, what other people think, results. Intrinsic motivation is experience, connection, the growth, the challenges, solving a puzzle. And there's stories that come through that versus just the words. The words are matter, but the story, the experience is it's like, and having people connect to that, those are good discussions to always be having. So.
Well, you talk about practice and these discussions that should be had. I wonder what role should coaching play? Is coaching playing in your expertise? Because I was a student athlete. I was an athlete for, you know, the better part of my young adult life. And I learned X's and O's and about being prompted on time. I never learned about how to think. I learned more as a university student from philosophy course on how to think than I did from, you know, my sports coaches. What role should coaches and not just individual sports, but team sports play in starting to use this language and teaching their athletes on their mental game in the same way they do their physical game, their technique, their X's and O's and et cetera?
Yeah, I think it's a really big important, part of the job and the role. And one way I like to is like, what's the point in helping an athlete be so talented and stronger and faster if they can't show up and be in the moment and like take advantage of it? And so now, do they need to become an expert in like helping an athlete develop, you know, these different tools and strategies? They're probably not going to be, but it's their own education and development and applying it themselves. And I think, you know, from my experience, coaches are way more open to this now, partially because I think it's more needed now. And the pressure and the weight on athletes. So like the coaches see that they got to do something to help support them because athletes are getting more in their own head with all the increased pressures and expectations in social media that are affecting them. So I do think it's an important role. And then being able to just at least have the language and the support or the guidance and just acknowledging it, right? Like half the problem is like athletes like, I don't need to work on that. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need to think about my thinking, like kind of thing. Like, it's like, what do you mean? Like it's non-negotiable. Like, it's not like you don't go to the gym to work out. Like, why would you not spend some time to slow down, think about who do you want to be and how do you want to show up? That gives you consistency. Slow down and think about how will I deal with adversity versus let's just hope adversity is going to happen. And being prepared for how you're going to respond when you're faced with it helps you be way more adaptable and resilient. And so these don't have to be very complicated things, but starting the language, the discussion, there's tons of great books outside of my own mind. So I think a pretty good book, but there's lots of other great books and resources and videos online for coaches to be educated, to share with their athletes. So, I think the tide's turning, the discussion is more open, coaches are more to it, but yeah, highly encourage coaches that haven't embraced it to continue to get educated, to learn more, to integrate it into their teachings with their athletes.
You mentioned it's more needed now. I remember having this argument early in LeBron's career when people were saying he wasn't clutch. And I just said, listen, I know you compare him to Magic and Michael, but, you know, if Tragic Magic was a hashtag and if people were videotaping, you know, Michael Jordan at casinos after losses, they might not have been as ruthless in the clutch moments. And so you're comparing apples and oranges, right? These players are in a different time. But that's just my own anecdotal belief. Is there literature or research, you know, that tells us that there are more factors that get into the mindset of athletes now than there have been in the past?
I don't want to say yes, because I haven't read it specifically. You know, my anecdotal, like, we have a pretty big coaching firm. It's the demand's higher than ever. We see so many athletes coming in and more people open to wanting it. And again, just if we just look at it from a high level view, like what has changed? One of the biggest things is social media. And what did social media do? It creates perfectionism. It creates where people see everybody else succeed, but they don't see them fail, right? They it expedites the social comparison. The social comparison could just eat up at the your inner self-worth and your that outside-in approach, which then just creates all this weight. There's way more money. There's way more attention and media goes to success. So we create this fantasy and nightmare around success is so awesome and losing and failure is so terrible. And so that creates weight. So it's growing in a way, which is great and awesome. And sports has all these benefits and enjoyment in it. But on the inside, it's harder to be an athlete now than it was before. It's also more lucrative in a way, like the ones that make it. But it comes at a cost. And that's what, like, I say this to athletes all the time. It's like making it to the NHL or making it pro or winning. Like, it's not all sunshine and rainbows. There's challenges that come with that. And so so for me, when I look at the landscape is definitely more challenging for today's athlete. You know, parents are very busy. I even look at, like, parenting is very different now than it was 30 years ago. Like, you know what I mean? Like, the expectations, the pressures, the distractions that can take your kid and focus and go into different ways. Like, things have changed. And, you know, that's what we do see. I'm pretty sure there's quite a bit of literature on and research on the rise of, you know, mental illness and the challenges and anxieties youth are experiencing. And so that's for sure. So, but I don't have any, like, direct research that I can cite on increase mental game challenges in youth sport, but I can anecdotally say I think it's on the rise. So, that'd be my quick answer there.
Well, we love the fact that you were able to give us some tips and tools, and you gave us a reference like Mindset First to dig deeper if we so choose. But it's badly needed and much appreciated. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Donovan.
Thanks so much to Dr. Preston, who is, as you heard, a mental performance coach and an author, a keynote speaker, has worked with PGA Tour and MLS and NHL and the NFL. If you are of interest of his work, drcassidypreston.com is the website. And if you want to read that book, it's a bestseller, it's on Amazon right now. Mindset First is the title of it. Mental performance coach, Dr. Cassidy Preston. Break free from the weight of results, play with confidence, and perform when it matters most. It matters to me that you listened for this long, so thank you. If you like what you listen to, please feel free to like, favorite, share, subscribe, tell a friend to tell a friend. And be sure to subscribe because we've got some really great episodes coming for you in the near future. Can't wait. Talk soon.